and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Farah Kilidar. Kilidar was born in Iraq but moved to the United Arab Emirates at age 10. She has extensive experience in the Middle East and once served as the executive director of the Alaska World Affairs Council. Kilidar talks about how global and regional events have shaped the Iraq of today. Her talk, Iraq, the Beginning of the End, was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and was recorded September 12th at the Hilton Anchorage. Kilidar is introduced by Garrett Wong, co-chair of the Alaska World Affairs Council. Here he is now.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's program. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Ms. Farah Kilidar. You know, Farah was born in Iraq, and at age 10, she and her family moved to the United Arab Emirates, and later she pursued her education in the United Kingdom. She was a solicitor of the Supreme Court of England and Wales, and given her experience in the Middle East, the UK, and the US, Farah has worked for international law firms where she has been involved in a wide range of corporate and commercial work. Farah has extensive experience in dealing with government institutions in the Middle East and the US. She has advised governments on a number of infrastructure projects, disputes, and legal reforms. At the outset of the Gulf War, Farah was a founding member of the Clifford Chance Multidisciplined Iraq Reconstruction Group. And over her career, Farah has made multiple presentations on Iraq's legal system and foreign investment climate. She's published articles on the subject and advised corporate and government clients on investing in Iraq and ongoing changes to the legal and political systems. Farah has served as an independent legal consultant advising the U.S. Department of Commerce on Iraq's commercial law development. Personally, well, I've had a chance to know Farah as she was our past executive director here at the Alaska World Affairs Council. Of present, she continues as the CEO of the World Affairs Council in Houston. Farah is here today to speak to us on the topic, Iraq, the beginning of the end. Please, a warm Alaska welcome back to our past Chief Executive Officer, Farah Kilidar.
Thank you, Garrett. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's wonderful to be back, actually, and wonderful to see so many familiar faces. Alaska was home to me for 3 years, and really, truly welcomed me in a way that other countries or states didn't. I was made to feel part of the community, and that made a huge difference. Up. There's no reason. Okay, I shall speak up. Last time I was asked to speak up, actually, was when I spoke here in 2006, which was the last time I was here. And I was unable to get closer to the microphone because I had a pregnant belly between me and the microphone. So luckily I can do it now. But when I started thinking about today's presentation and what it is I need to be speaking about, I decided to start with reference to that 2006 talk that I gave. It was an important time in the war with Iraq. It marked the beginning of what ended up being a civil war. I attempted at the time to tackle the question of the many factions that govern Iraq and that influence the control of Iraq and its people. It was my assertion then that unless and until we acknowledge that various players, unless and until the world powers take responsibility for the role they have played in creating the Iraq of today and work towards a joint peaceful solution, The country I was born in will cease to exist. I'm saddened to stand again today at what I believe to be the precipice, quite possibly the beginning of the end. I understand this is not a cheerful note, and the music I put prior to starting this program wasn't cheerful either, but it is representative of today's Iraq. One could argue that the beginning was in 2003 with the invasion, the US invasion, or in 1991 with the launch of Desert Storm, or even 2011 when the last US troops left Iraq. In fact, there has been many a discussion as to whether any of these events played a role. I would argue that no single event, act or inact, was the beginning, but rather the cumulative errors, misjudgments, ever-changing policies, and conflicting interests that have led us to this point. Iraq and its people, with their conflicts, mistrust, and psyche, did not simply come about. What we witness today is the unfortunate consequence of many a lost opportunity. Ill-preparedness, lack of leadership, regional players, a worn-down American electorate, not to mention decades of a despotic rule. Iraqis have, after all, endured 40 years of repression, 3 major conflicts, ethnic cleansing, economic sanctions, occupation, lawlessness, civil war, and now what can best be described as slow-motion genocide. In fact, this is how it was described by the spokesperson for the St. Thomas Chaldean Diocese in reference to the recent attempts by ISIS to eradicate the Christian population in Iraq. There is now a very distinct possibility that Christianity may cease to exist in a country to which the apostles brought the gospel in the first century. It may be hard to remember, but it was not that long ago that Iraq was a religiously pluralistic society, as we can see from this map. Whilst Kurds and Sunni Arabs each made up around 20% of Iraq's population, in 2003, at the beginning of the war, some 10% of that population was comprised of smaller religious minorities, including Armenians, Syriac, Christians, Baha'is, Jews, and Yazidis, as well as ethnic minorities such as Shabaks and Turkmen. And if you recall, in the recent news, we heard a lot about the Yazidis that had been stuck in the mountains in northern Iraq, escaping ISIS. Most of these groups had lived in Iraq for more than 1,000 years, and most, though not all, enjoyed a degree of protection as minorities under the Saddam regime. Since then, however, repeated waves of displacement in Iraq have changed the country's demographic landscape. Between 2003 and 2006, about 1 million Iraqis were displaced by the escalating violence in the country, adding to another 1 million that were thought to have been displaced during the Saddam regime. Things took an ominous turn in February 2006 with the bombing of Al-Askari Mosque in the north by what was then determined to be Al-Qaeda, who attempted and indeed succeeded in inciting violence and sectarian divide. In fact, in the course of about a year, a staggering 2.7 million Iraqis, representing 5% of the population, had fled to neighboring countries. And in fact, what I'll do is take you to the next map, which shows Baghdad more specifically. And you see the map in 2003 versus the one in 2009. You will find that the green part over here represents mixed areas. And in fact, that's pretty much where I lived, and it was very much a mixed area of Shiites, Sunnis, Christians, all minorities. And Iraq, Baghdad itself as the capital, was known to be the center of all the different groups. However, by 2009, with the civil war, we've ended up with this picture, where the majority of Baghdad is Shiite now. and with a very small center that is mixed. And in fact, there are, if you recall, in around 2007 and 2008, a lot of barriers were put up between neighborhoods, and those barriers remain to this day. Whilst Kurds and Sunni Arabs each made up around 20%, actually, we just talked about this. The reason I mention this and the reason I show this map, because it's an important distinction to make. The distinction that Iraq has indeed been home to multiple ethnicities and religions. I often hear on the news or read in papers that the US should not get involved in century-old problems. This is an assertion that, in the very least, is inaccurate and at best misleading. The best framework for understanding the Middle East and the complicated and violent regional politics of the region was set out by a Brookings Institute paper analysis this July. It described the politics of the Middle East in the guise of a Cold War among regional players, both states and non-state players, in which Iran and Saudi Arabia play the leading roles. It is a cold war because these two main actors have never and probably will never face each other militarily. Rather, their contest for influence plays out in the domestic political systems of the regional countries. It is a balance of power game. The Brookings Institute goes on to explain the links between domestic conflicts, transnational affinities, and regional state ambitions, which are important to understand in order to understand what's going on in the Middle East today. It states, domestic conflicts for power lead local actors to seek out regional allies who can supply them with money, guns, ideological cover, and diplomatic support. They look for regional allies who share in some way their own political and ideological positions, with whom they feel some kinship or ideological or identity grounds. The regional powers need these ideological or identity links to consolidate their relations with their local clients. Providing clients with material support is important, but it is not enough to sustain influence. States that have the military and material potential to reach for regional domination, but lack these ideological and identity links across the borders, such as Israel, are severely hampered in their ability to have an impact on the new Middle East and the Cold War. So rather than seeing the conflicts of the Middle East as a top-down phenomenon driven by states animated by sectarian divide, as is commonly the misconception, it is more accurate to view it as a bottom-up dynamic. The weakness or breakdown of state authority creates domestic political vacuums into which outsiders are drawn. These outsiders generally do not have to force themselves into these countries. They are, in fact, invited by different factions. Those factions are vying for power against their local rivals. It's important to bear in mind that state weakness in the domestic political sense is not the same as state weakness in the international sense. So, for example, countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, or Kuwait, who are internationally weak in terms of their ability to defend themselves, they are, however, very strong in terms of the ability of the state to control its citizens and the citizens being able to identify themselves with the state and having that loyalty towards the state. Until 2003, and as long as these areas of state weakness required marginal state-to-state relations dominated the international politics of the Middle East. So if you recall, in the 80s and early 90s, the politics of the Middle East were primarily with regard to the Iraq-Iran war or the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq. They were pretty much border disputes. However, the U.S. invasion of Iraq shifted that dynamic. Whilst the capacity of the Iraqi state had eroded significantly after the first Gulf War in 1991 and the sanction years that followed, The American invasion brought the final blow, as it eroded the authoritarian state's three major pillars. It banned the ruling Ba'ath Party, it dissolved the military, and it purged the country of experienced cadres who were members of that party, and which really represented a high percentage of Iraqi society. This, in turn, opened up Iraq's political system to outside political influence and interests, most notably from Iran, thus marking the beginnings of the Middle East Cold War and the precursor to today's events. The breaking up of the Iraqi state enormously increased the significance of sectarianism in regional politics. In fact, when I was growing up in Iraq, just a few years ago, in the 80s, you really did not hear about sectarian differences. Most people did not know whether they were Sunni or Shiite, or if they did, it didn't really play much of a significance. Intermarriages were pretty normal. And whilst there might have been some underlying animosity between the groups, nobody really spoke of it, and you definitely did not hear about it in the news as you do these days. So whilst sectarian and ethnic identities had been important in Iraqi politics since the days of the monarchy, their importance was very minimal. And that the reason for that is the state was very strong, with other identities and loyalties taking precedence. So I very much identified myself as an Iraqi first, Muslim second, all the other ethnicities didn't really come into it at all. With the collapse of the state, however, in 2003, sectarian and ethnic Kurdish identities became primary in the fight for power. Shiite parties looked to Iran for support, Sunnis looked to Saudi Arabia. The sectarian character of the new Middle East Cold War was thus set. When Syria eventually descended into civil war and conflict during the Arab uprisings of 2011, this sectarian element of the conflict in the Middle East intensified. The weakening and retreat of the state drove people in these countries to look to sectarian identities and groups for the protection and material sustenance that the state either could or would not provide anymore. Therefore, the retreat of the state made it possible for Iran, Saudi Arabia, and other regional countries such as Qatar and UAE to play an increasing role in the civil conflicts of the region. This is now the core dynamic driving the Middle East Cold War. While Saudi Arabia and Iran, not to mention the Kurds in northern Iraq, did not create the state weakness and sectarian identities of these countries, they certainly are taking advantage whilst advancing their own interests in a classic balance of power game. And in fact, if you look at this map, you will see the division of Muslims around the world, the green representing Sunni Muslims, the purple representing Shiite Muslims, which add up to about 10% of Muslims. So if you take that into account, it's a bit surprising that the conflict has got as bad as it has, considering the small portion of Shiite Muslims. However, if you go to the next map, you'll find that even within those countries themselves, it happens that the Shiites reside in the parts where there is a lot of oil wells. So in the case of Iraq, almost more than 60% of the oil is in the south, and that is purely Shiite. It's the same even with Saudi, even though the Shiites are very much a minority there. Most of the oil is in the region where the Shiites reside. And that's where explanation as to why this is important, why the struggle between Iran and Saudi Arabia is so important. This is part of it. It is in this environment and with these dynamics that ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, re-emerged. Formerly known as Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia and guilty of wreaking havoc and inciting sectarian violence during the worst years of the U.S. occupation between 2006 and 2009, they were eventually driven underground following the surge. They re-emerged in Syria with the Arab uprisings of 2011, and have since been expanding their influence with support from various players in the region. There have been many accusations that donors and sympathizers, mostly from Qatar, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, are solely responsible for the group's existence. Whilst it is true that some wealthy individuals from the Gulf have funded extremist groups in Syria, and whilst it is true that Saudi Arabia and Qatar, believing that Sunni political Islam was a true vehicle for their power, funded groups that had strong Islamic credentials and which groups were either taken over by ISIS or joined, and whilst Turkey, for its part, operated a highly questionable policy of border enforcement, in which weapons and money flooded into Syria, it would be too simplistic to state that those countries, and specifically those governments, have directly funded ISIS. Indirectly, however, and through a combination of shoddy policy and naivete, money and weapons have surely made their way into the hands of ISIS. In fact, if one were to look even closer, since their advancement into Iraq, ISIS has received support from Sunni tribes in the north, the same tribes which the US had funded in what was at the time called the Sunni Awakening. And if you see from the map here, this has been one of the proposals for the federal option in Iraq, and that option has been spoken of really since 2003. And you find that the yellow part, which is mostly Sunni Arab, where the awakening, the Sunni awakening, took place in 2008, if I recall, and that's how the US managed to flush out Al-Qaeda from Iraq. That's the same area that has actually been occupied by ISIS since 2012. We hadn't heard much about it then, but they'd been working on that since then. We only started hearing about it in June when they entered Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq. ISIS, on its part, has proven to be more media savvy and far better organized than its predecessors. The Islamic State has put in place what appear to be the beginnings of a quasi-state structure. Ministries, law courts, and even a rudimentary taxation system, which incidentally taxes people less than the state used to, which I suppose is a great way of getting support. ISIS has displayed a consistent pattern since it first began to take territory in early 2013. It would go into a town, it would take control of a town quickly, secure the water, flour, and hydrocarbon resources of the area, as was the case with the Mosul Dam, which was a very strategic dam in Iraq, while centralizing distribution and thereby making the local population dependent on its survival. Dependency and support, however, are not the same. And it's impossible to quantify how many of the Islamic State's so-called citizens are willing partners or simply acquiescing to its rule out of need for stability and fear for punishment. I would probably go out on a limb and say that a great majority of the citizens are merely riding it out, and that the more time lapses, the less support ISIS will receive from those citizens. One would argue that it is time for those countries, namely the Gulf countries and Turkey, not to mention, of course, Iraqis themselves, to do some soul searching. There are some positive signs that such introspection has indeed started to take place, following the announcement made by President Obama on Wednesday. Such announcement, which basically spoke of degrading and ultimately destroying ISIS, which is a nice general legal term where, you know, it's very hard to fail on that front. It was followed by signing a joint communique issued by the US with 10 Arab countries. And that communique was even less definitive in that those countries committed to contributing as appropriate, as and when appropriate, without specific reference to how. Nevertheless, and I know I've read some headline news today as to how shoddy a commitment that is, this is the biggest commitment we've seen from the region since 2003, and it is the farthest they've come to uniting against a common enemy. So I actually look at it as a positive move. That, coupled with the appointment of a new Iraqi prime minister and the formation of his cabinet, raises some glimmers of hope. In time, Abadi's moderate tone could bring about the formation of an inclusive government capable of addressing the legitimate needs of all Iraqis, especially important being the need to include Sunni minorities. Whilst regional players have played a significant role in bringing us to this point, just as much as the US invasion of Iraq had started the domino effect, these same countries would not benefit from the creation of an extreme caliphate in their midst. Whilst Iran might be willing to avoid the establishment of an extreme Sunni state within Iraq, Saudi Arabia would equally resist the strengthening of an Iranian influence in the southern part of the country. To that end, both countries, those same countries vying for power in the region, might have a common goal of stalling the advancement of ISIS and preventing the establishment of a caliphate amongst their midst. And as you'll see from the maps there, the yellow represents what ISIS claims to be their power base, which is a major chunk of Syria and northern Iraq. The other map in the orange represents the actual occupation, the towns that they've occupied, and in fact, the shady part is where they have support. So they haven't really occupied it, but they have support from the locals on the ground, which, as I stated earlier, is really more of a survival technique. Ironically, it's taken new chaos in Iraq to pull the US out of its post-Iraq war aversion to engagement in the Middle East. In outlining what the next phase of US policy there will look like, President Obama must make clear that urgent action, whilst necessary, will not mean immediate results. In Washington, foreign policy crises are covered as breaking news, but in reality, they develop over many years and take even longer to resolve. Complaints about the inconsistency of current American policy in the Middle East are almost as common as complaints about its passivity, especially in the last few years. For example, the United States is trying to limit Iranian influence in Syria whilst negotiating with Iran on nuclear weapons. It is backing the Iranian allied government in Iraq against a Sunni Muslim insurgency, whilst at the same time opposing the Iranian allied government in Syria against a Sunni insurgency. It calls for the downfall of the Assad regime, but backs away from the use of force against it, and then becomes indirectly its partner in an agreement to rid Syria of its chemical weapons. It argues for democracy in Egypt, but refuses to call the military coup there by its name. These policies, taken together, are certainly inconsistent when viewed through the eyes of people in the Middle East. In some instances, they support the pro-Iranian side, in others, the pro-Saudi side. The United States, however, should not and does not define its interests this way. It focuses on its core interest of securing oil production and oil flows, combating terrorist groups that target the United States and its allies, and preventing the spillover of regional violence into the politics of stable American allies. Concentrating American policy on the states that actually govern, acting multilaterally both to pressure foes and support friends, and remembering that US interests are not as directly engaged in the Middle East Cold War as those of the local parties, is a fine and key balance to riding out this particular violent and difficult period in the region. The longer-term challenge of the new Middle East, however, is as daunting as it is simple. It is building states that can effectively govern their societies. Effective governance in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Yemen, and Libya would drastically reduce the opportunities for regional powers to meddle across their borders, and thus limit the scope of regional balance of power struggles. Sub-state actors in effectively governed states will have less reason to seek out foreign patrons, and if they do, an effective state will prevent them from establishing such ties. That's part of the reason why in the 80s, Al-Qaeda found residence in Afghanistan and not anywhere in the Middle East. Effectively, governed states do not become havens for transnational terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. Building effective governance that is basically democratic and respectful of citizens' human and civil rights is an even more daunting a task. The kind of governance is the most stable and effective in the long run. But there is no consensus as to how a state reaches that sweet spot of stable and decent government. The road to that point is not only bumpy, it's foggy. And one could argue the United States has demonstrated in Iraq that it is much harder to state build than to state destroy. In the meantime, there are many ways for countries to make their own regional contributions, such as shutting down channels for ISIS funding, closing Turkey's borders to ISIS fighters and weapons, urging Sunni tribes to work with the Shiite-led government in Baghdad, and providing intelligence to coalition members. It is also time for Iraqis to set aside their sectarian and ethnic differences, for national unity and the desire for a peaceful, democratic Iraq to prevail. Failing that, the Iraq I was born into, the Iraq my parents and grandparents were born into, is unlikely to survive this tumultuous period in history. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Farah Kilidar. Iraqi by birth, Kilidar has extensive experience in the Middle East. Her talk, Iraq, the Beginning of the End, was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and was recorded September 12th at the Hilton Anchorage. From here, the talk moves into a question and answer period with the audience.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. Would you help refresh our memories on how the current state of Iraq was created and to what extent it was in position by the West and by Europe?
Wow, that's you're testing my history knowledge there. But it is a very interesting question because there's been a lot of mention of Iraq being not a real state, one that was just put together by the Western allies after the first Gulf War, the first World War. Whilst that's true to some extent, it did follow lines along which Mesopotamia was built. So, whilst it wasn't known as Iraq, it was definitely Iraq and Syria were very much part of Mesopotamia as we know it. And a lot of those groups had lived together for centuries. But in answer to your question, Iraq was formed after the First World War. And it was following defeat of the Ottoman Empire, which had control of that region, pretty much. That's one of the most sensitive questions you could ask in the Middle East, because it's where they see where the loyalty or trust of Western countries sort of becomes questionable. Reason being is there was a promise on the part of the British Empire at the time to support the establishment of individual Arab nations if they were to support them in defeating the Ottoman Empire. At the same time, they entered into an agreement with France to actually divide the countries among themselves upon the war coming to an end. And that is, in fact, what happened. Some countries were then ruled by France, such as Lebanon and Syria. Some were ruled by Britain, and the bounty was divided accordingly. So that really started the distrust that you see in the Middle East of Western powers.
You mentioned a lot of like U.S. foreign inconsistencies. It was like a giant jigsaw puzzle. What would you recommend to like consistent, like make our foreign policy consistent, or what would you suggest to like combat that? Because I feel like we're just shooting ourselves in the leg and giving ourselves a crutch or something, to give it like a metaphor.
No, it's a very good question, and it's taken me time to get to this conclusion, but I don't think it's possible to make it consistent. because I think it was in the New York Times a few weeks ago, they had a very good summary of the different factions in the region and where the U.S. supports one versus the other and how they overlap. And even within the region itself, you know, where, for instance, Iran supports the government in Syria to override the opposition. It also supports the minority in Lebanon, and same with Saudi Arabia. The loyalties and the different support that you get depends on the specific countries, because each country has its own distinct policy needs and influence and so on. So for the U.S. to have one unified Middle East policy or one policy that is consistent, I don't think we'd ever get to that personally, but this is more sort of, it's not realistic. I would like to see less pendulum shifting between one party to another. So going from an all-out war where it's boots on the grounds and so on to hands off, and you know, we'll sit back and watch what happens. That does far more damage than anything else.
Thank you for speaking today.
Thank you.
I would like to ask, in terms of a humanitarian crisis, what are we looking at?
What we've seen in Syria over the last... Oh, sorry. And I think the question was, in terms of humanitarian crisis, what are we looking at? Right. In terms of Syria, it's the worst humanitarian crisis that we'd ever seen. We're talking... approximately half the population of Syria had been displaced within or outside the country. In terms of Iraq, you know, Iraq has seen so many of these shifts, of these crises. In the 80s, we had, like I said, about 1 million people that were refugees on the Iranian border as a result of Saddam. During the first Gulf War, we had a lot of refugees in the north and the south. And then during the war in 2003 and right till 2011, a lot of people left Iraq. What you're seeing now, which is in some respects more significant, not in terms of lives, but it's the eradication of minorities. And so the Assyrian minorities, the Christians, the Chaldeans, these are the original people of Iraq. So if you're going to talk about Iraqis, these are the Iraqis. And they have by far now been eradicated. So it's pretty bad. And what you don't hear in the news is a number of villages in the north that have been occupied by ISIS. And their take on it is to kill all Shiites. Well, that's 60% of the Iraqi population. So it's pretty drastic.
A member of the audience asks how relevant the Arab League is.
It's not. It's not relevant at all. It's actually a joke in the Middle East when you mention the Arab League. Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you say that, having a regional player, a major regional player. And I'm not sure I can explain this, but when you mentioned that, there was a part of me that thought I would much rather have the U.S. interfere than any of the regional players. As much as there is conflicting politics and interests and so on vis-a-vis the U.S., you know, it has a history of human rights and democracy and so on. Getting any of those other countries to be the major player is a scary thought. And in fact, that's pretty much what they've been trying to do for the last few years. You know, Iran has been trying to be the major player in the region. Saudi Arabia is trying to take that role. Turkey tried for a while and actually succeeded in being quite a major player. But I'm not sure that's really the right way to go. I think the best way to go is for the U.S. to remain engaged, vital, and for them to involve regional players as well as influence regional players. That's where I still think the control needs to happen from here.
Hi, Farah. Thank you for being here. So this is along the lines of the question I kind of asked you last night to let kind of people here know what you said, that some of the best and the brightest and the most talented have left Iraq because of what's happening. So what's left there to have the counter-revolution or to bring it back to where it should be?
I know that's a very good question, and it's a sad one to answer. You're right. There are several waves of Iraqi migrations. There are those who left in the 80s, and then they got the 90s, and then the last war. And actually, during this last war, it wasn't just a question of people leaving the country. It was very much a targeted brain drain. So a lot of the doctors and teachers and, you know, professionals were targeted and killed. By the same token, when I went back in 2003, at the very beginning of the war, I wasn't necessarily very well received to begin with, because the feeling there was, well, you know, you've stayed out all this time, you didn't suffer, you didn't go through the sanctions and the second, you know, the Gulf War and all that. You're just coming now to reap the benefit. Whereas really, in essence, a lot of Iraqis did go back, were very keen on going back to rebuild Iraq and take that knowledge and know-how and all that. But they were faced with resistance to begin with. And that's when you saw a resistance to the governing council, because they were all outsiders. They were deemed outsiders. Nevertheless, unless Iraq stabilizes and unless this government tries to bring in all the different factions and really involves the Sunnis, and I would like to think that we have got to a point where everybody realizes that this threat of ISIS way supersedes any other differences they might have. If that were to happen and we get a unified government representative of the whole country, then I would like to think that you'll see Iraqis going back again. I mean, there are still, my father still talks of going back. So, you know, it's possible.
So, assuming that we are successful in rolling back ISIS and eliminating them, or at least preventing them from having any influence in Iraq in the 3 to 5 year period that they say that's going to take, what is your opinion on whether it might not be better for Iraq in the very long term, I'm saying 10, 20, 30 years out from now, for it to be partitioned or federalized anyway? Might there be better governance overall in the long, long term?
You know, unlike probably most Iraqis, and I would be accused of not being nationalist for saying this, I'm not necessarily against partitioning Iraq or some kind of a federation, but not this way, not with ISIS. And the other problem with partitioning Iraq is you have a country where, I don't know if you recall from the map, you've got the Kurds in the north, and they have about 40% of the oil reserves. You've got the remaining 60% in the south, which is with the Shiites, so that would be the second region. And then you've got the central Sunni region, which really doesn't have any oil reserves. And that's the region that would be supported by Saudi Arabia, for instance. So it doesn't benefit a lot of people that it gets separated, and that's part of the reason why it hasn't happened yet. One can look at the last 10 years and think this is a natural consequence, and in fact, at the very beginning of June, when ISIS got into Mosul, that's pretty much what the Kurds did. The Kurds moved their army and took over 40% extra land, and we're going to go and get a referendum on independence. The reason that turned around is because ISIS then turned around and started attacking the Kurds. So then now we're seeing more of a unified Iraq opposing ISIS. So in some respects, maybe naive on my part to think, but I think it could have been the best thing that has happened to Iraq in the last 10 years, because we're actually now for once thinking of ourselves as Iraqi and all standing against the one common enemy.
Hi. First of all, I just want to thank you. And usually I know how to put a question together, but on this one, I really don't. So I'm going to ask you if you could talk a little bit about women's rights and the entire subject.
Yeah. I debated with Lisa whether I should walk in here covered from head to toe and, you know, which would be very accurate, sadly to say. Women's rights in Iraq. Iraq is one of those countries, and I've made this quote several times, where daughters are less educated than their mothers. And when I grew up in Iraq, you ever so rarely saw women covered up. Women's rights were pretty, actually, they were ahead of the rest of the region. The family law in Iraq was the leading one in the region, in that it did not take religious texts and so on. It actually sort of applied various texts from French law and so on. And, you know, my mother was a professional mother. It was, you know, it was pretty, you know, not that different from here. When I went back in 2003, it was a very different picture. Most women were covered up. A lot of girls were taken out of schools, primarily for fear of being attacked. And that started actually even in the 90s. During the sanction years, a lot of poverty took over, so a lot of parents chose to take out their daughters out of schools. And then during this war, the last war, it became a survival thing. So in answer to your question, no, women's rights are going very much in the wrong direction. One of the very, I was one of the people that was very much against the constitution being passed. Because it applied Islamic law, and where there is a conflict between democracy or Islamic law will prevail. Following that constitution, Iraq then adopted a new family law, which actually was very detrimental to women. So I think I would go as far as to say, as far as the whole region, women's rights are very much going in the wrong direction.
Hi, thank you very much for addressing this complicated subject. I think a number of the questions seem to me to be touched on the issue of you might say, demographics, and I'm wondering how much what your view is on that underlying demographic issue, and I'll give my own prospect on that, which is I look out there and I see no economy. Whatever economy was there has been destroyed. The economy is the military economy. If I'm a young man out there with a Sunni religious bent, you know, I've got no prospect of a job. I've got no prospect of getting married. So, and there's all these cool firearms there, and I'm not educated particularly. And it meets the religious objective. I can be so pure by getting on this crusade. So it seemed to me this situation is going to feed itself as long as there is not more of a rebuilt economy. Mm-hmm. And that being the case, I don't see what American bombing of there is going to do much because, I mean, if I'm a young male, I think it reminds me that I don't like Americans because they seem to come over and kill everybody over here. So it seems to me like a backward policy. Your opinion?
I agree with you totally in that commercial development and jobs is the number one answer, not just for Iraq, but for the whole region. If I'm correct, the number of the unemployment in Iraq is about 40%. And that was always my assertion, even at the beginning of the 2003 war, that the U.S. needs to concentrate on jobs, 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 just like it's the primary decider in elections here. It's the same thing. However, we've got to such a bad point now that no way is that going to be tackled unless and until you deal with the bigger problem of ISIS and the bigger problem of ISIS expanding its influence beyond its current territory. It might very well be the case that ISIS will remain where it is and nobody will be able to push them back, that's too late as far as northern Iraq is concerned. But it's vital that they're stopped from expanding. And that, coupled with exerting influence on a unified Iraqi government and assisting that government in building its soft infrastructure. That's vital. The U.S. had done a lot of that during the war. A lot of money was spent on that. People didn't really know that much about it. It wasn't, you know, headline news. But that was scaled back substantially since 2011. Which, you know, if you were to go to D.C. and speak to people in the State Department or Commerce, it's one of their biggest regrets, because all that good work that had been done, unfortunately, has been undone. So in answer to your question, yes, it's vital. You need jobs. These, you know, young men and women are graduating from university and there's no hope for a job. But in order to get to that point, you really need first to scale back ISIS and then remain active in the policy of the Middle East, remain active in how the new government governs.
Well, Farah, thank you again. All things must come to an end, and so we are there.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Farah Kilidar. Kilidar's talk, Iraq, The Beginning of the End, was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and was recorded September 12th at the Hilton Anchorage. Did you know that all Alaska World Affairs Council lectures are available as podcasts through our website? You can find them online at alaskapublic.org. Scroll down to the bottom of the page and click on podcasts. You'll find lectures from the Alaska World Affairs Council and more. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.